Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Mary, and I'll be the host for today's forum. The Hinckley Institute was established in 1965 through the generous bequest of the Nobel Foundation and Robert H. Hinckley. The Institute is dedicated to teaching students respect for practical politics and the principle of citizen involvement in government. The Hinckley Institute offers paid internships to students of all majors here locally in Washington, D.C., and in 35 countries around the globe. The Hinckley Institute also offers classes, the nation's only campaign management minor, week-long experiences in Washington, D.C., and over $70,000 in academic scholarships. We invite students to go next door or to our website at www.hinckley.utah.edu for more information. The title of today's forum is The High Cost of the High Cost of Healthcare, Cost to Health, Education, the Economy, and National Security. Today's guest, Dr. Robert P. Huffner, is this year's recipient of the Distinguished Alumni Award and is a healthcare and public policy expert. After graduating from the University of Utah, he went on to receive a master's degree in city planning from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and a doctorate in finance from Harvard University. He is a noted healthcare and public policy expert, and he directs the Institute of Comparative Health Services Research here at the University of Utah, where he is also a professor emeritus of political science. Huffner formerly worked in city, county, state, and federal governments and held the Governor Scott M. Matheson Presidential Endowed Chair in Health Policy and Management here at the U. Please join me in welcoming our guest.
Thank you. And I might just add to that because it becomes important in what my perspective is. Before I became a faculty member here at the university, I was in government administration and mostly in staff roles. I was staff to two Utah governors and then to the U.S. Secretary of Treasury. And in those roles, was deeply involved in policy issue and kept being thrown into healthcare because healthcare was clearly becoming an increasing kind of a challenge for government at all levels. So that's how I drifted into healthcare. But I'm pleased to be here. I have a lot of respect for the Hinckley Institute, and it also I see Mr. Hinckley's portrait back there. When I went to MIT, I lived in the home of Mr. Hinckley's brother. Shows what a small world it is, and I didn't go back there knowing that's where I was going to be. Of course, Friday is Sequestration Day and is much in the news right now. Will suggest is that the real problem that we have, which is much more serious than Friday's, which is not to say Friday is not a truly serious problem, but the real problem that we have in this country is the high cost of health care, and that's what we need to address to deal with the long-term economic strength of the country. I will talk about, as you mentioned, are four aspects to that. And the title of the talk is the high costs, that's plural, the high costs of the high cost of healthcare, and how the high cost of healthcare then becomes significant in these other areas. One of them is simply in terms of what the high cost does to limit the quality and accessibility of healthcare. Secondly, what it's doing, particularly at the state level, in terms of threatening the financing of public education. Third, its crucial role in determining the extent to which our economy is really competitive, and what that means then in terms of our personal income and in terms of the economic strength of the country. And fourthly, what it means in terms of national security, which is a problem that I became particularly sensitive to a couple of years ago in time that my wife and I spent in Vietnam. But I'll get to that. So anyway, I'll go through those four areas, and that'll be the substance of what I want to say. But then we'll also take a few minutes to talk about whether or not there's any possibility of dealing with the cost. How do we, what would make us think that we can deal with the cost of healthcare, and then following on that, what are some of the ways that we might do it? So I will go through that. Essentially, the problem is a problem of our political capacity in this country. What are the limits of our political capacity? Today in the Financial Times, one of their columnists, John Plender, says, "Thank goodness for American government and American economy." I didn't know that anyone would be thankful at this point for what we are, but he's thankful for it by comparing it to Italy. Well, maybe that's one way that we can get some hope. At least we're not Italy today after their elections over the weekend. But whether or not we've got the political capacity to deal with the problems of sequestration and the fiscal cliff and so forth, that's in serious question at this moment. And I would say that the chance that we have the political capacity to deal with our healthcare costs is less than our capacity to deal with these financial economic issues that we're talking about right now. Now, to go through those four ways that the healthcare costs are creating other costs for us, to the extent that we will have to manage the cost of healthcare, and I don't think there's any question that we will in some way manage the cost of healthcare. If you look at the projection of the cost of healthcare in this country, and you carry it out a few decades or a generation or two, it's consuming more than the total GNP of the country. Well, as economists say, that projections that lead us to an impossible situation are probably not going to be good predictors. Well, we can't possibly spend 100% of our GDP on healthcare, so something will happen. But what has a good chance of happening is that we will substantially reduce the access and or the quality of healthcare, which will be a burden to all of our children anyway, if not to, well, it'll be a burden to you in terms of your lifespans and certainly to our children. Now, the reason that both the access and quality are at risk is because there are three ways that we could deal with the cost of healthcare. One way is to cut back on the access. Now, the Affordable Care Act has done just the opposite. But already we have states, and this includes Utah, that are petitioning the federal government to have some flexibility in terms of how this is administered, and that flexibility would include restrictions on access. A second way to deal with it is to reduce the quality. And that has some high probability for the reason that the third way to deal with it is to deal with the cost of delivering the care. And that means to deal with it in terms of what are the various healthcare providers extracting from the economy in order to provide the healthcare? Now, those interests, that is the pharmaceuticals, the medical device makers, the health insurers, the hospitals, the physicians, all of those people are much better represented in Congress than are the enrollees, that is, the presumed patients. So that means as we get in to these tough decisions, that it's going to be the enrollees that'll be particularly at risk in losing because they are not as well represented. So that's why I would argue that particularly at risk is the quality of health care and to some extent accessibility to it. Now, there's also another risk to health, and that is to the extent that health care is very expensive, it's going to be undermining the appropriations for public health, for disease prevention and health promotion. It's already doing that in Utah. It's done that ever since we created a new health department that combined Medicaid and public health. That Medicaid is always the big actor in that, and that it means that the public health interests have a difficult time gaining the kind of funding that would be helpful. Now, I'll move on to the second area, that is education. Education is going to be, and already is, seriously disadvantaged by the increasing costs of healthcare. Now, that's particularly true to the extent that these costs are covered by state governments, because the primary expenditure of state government in the United States is for public education. And yet the primary demand already, even though, well, let's see, the primary demand for increasing state revenue is from health. And if you look at the Utah state budget that we are now in, that even though the governor and almost everyone else who talked about where the priorities ought to be in the budget that we now have, not the one that's now being considered, but the one that we're now operating under, although the same thing's happening, I think, this year, that even though all of them were saying that the priority needed to go to education, when you look at what actually happened, that of the major expenditures in the state budget in this present year, the major expenditures in terms of their relative increase in their appropriation, the appropriation for health care was far and away the one that had the biggest increase, percentage increase. And education, in spite of the fact that all were saying that that was the top priority, that education actually came out with a smaller part of the incremental change in the budget for this year than what education had in the total budget. So it meant that education had, by the time we were through with the Appropriations Act, education had a smaller part of the budget than what it had had before, even though it was supposedly the number one priority. Well, that will keep happening as long as the state governments are providing a significant part of the healthcare costs. Now, are they providing a significant part? That's true right now, even though most of the governmental expenditures for healthcare is being done at the federal level. Right now, the total costs of healthcare in this country, of the total cost, something over, well, about 50% of it is covered by the federal government. Whether it's less than 50 or more, slightly less or slightly more, depends on how you make the count. If you make the count only in terms of direct expenditures, it's still slightly less. If you add into it the count of the tax preferences that are provided to health care, it is significantly over 50%. So I think it's fair to say that 50% of the total expenditures right now are paid by the federal government. Now, if you add the state government expenditures to it, the total governmental share of total of health care costs are something over 60%. Now, to the extent that we shape the expenditures so that more of them are covered by the state government, these will be competing even more with public education. To the extent that we do it so more of it's covered by the federal government, it'll be competing particularly with the other major federal expenditures. That's the payment of the national debt. You can't change that, I mean, except that we get surpluses sometime in the future. But you have to pay that back. So what are they in terms of the so-called controllables? Well, even if we include other things other than the debt, that the major expenditures of the federal government are defense and income support. Now, the income support that the federal government pays is not so much what we used to call welfare, that is, the income support for low-income people. The primary federal expenditure for income support is for the elderly, is for Social Security. So that's where the primary competition is going to be from healthcare expenditures at the federal level. It'll be with income support for the elderly. Now, what would be the fairer and the more economically helpful way to set up this political competition? Would it be for healthcare to be competing with education, or would it be for healthcare to be competing with the income of the elderly? Well, I can say that's pretty easy. Obviously, we shouldn't compete with the elderly. Both in terms of political fairness and in terms of the economic future of this country, it ought to be that it would be competing with the income of the elderly, not with the expenditures for education. So the competition ought to be at the federal level, not at the state level. It ought to be at the federal level for another reason, too. The federal is raising its money throughout the country, so it has a more even base for the expenditures for the health care. So for at least those two reasons, it ought to be at the federal level. Now, getting to the third point, to the domestic economy. The primary problem that we face both as a government in this country in terms of our fiscal soundness and in terms of the competitiveness of our industry is the cost of health care in this country compared with the cost of health care in other countries. We spend roughly twice as much per person for health care in this country as other economically developed countries spend. Now, when we're spending 18% of our gross domestic product for health care, that means the others are spending about 9%. So it means we have a tax on business in this country of about 9%. Now, that weakens our economy in general. It weakens the tax base for our government. But it also weakens how much income and what's the value of that income that we each as individuals have. So it's a serious burden on our economic strength and our fiscal strength. Now, getting to the last one, that is national security. Here I will go back to experience that Dixie and I had about, was it 3 years now? We were part of a group of about 24 people who were invited to go to Vietnam to kind of talk to leaders there. And we were people from all over the country. We had the former president of Ford Motor, and we had some people who had been very much involved in other aspects of health and the military and so forth. So it was kind of a broad representation from across the country and across economic interests. We had a very interesting visit, coming back and reflecting on it, it was pretty clear, to at least to me, and I think to the rest of us, that Vietnam faced some serious problems, and that to a large extent they were problems with China. Now, they weren't concerned that China was going to invade Vietnam as it did just after we left Vietnam. There wasn't much concern that it would do that. But there were three kinds of concerns. One had to do with the South China Sea. And the competition or the questioning as to who really had jurisdiction over the South China Sea. Now, that's important for several reasons. One is that's the major route for shipping around Southeast Asia and up to the Philippines, or more importantly, to China and to Japan. So it's an essential route. And anyone who can control that has a major kind of political power in the region. A second reason that the South China Sea was important is there is speculation, and it's at a significant level, that there are energy resources that can be tapped there around the islands. The question is, who would be able to tap those resources? Okay, so that's one problem with China, because China was already laying claim to most of the South China Sea. And other countries like the Philippines and Vietnam and other countries in the area had counterclaims. And it's a little hard for a country like the Philippines to stand up to a country like China. Isn't that right? that's one problem that Vietnam was having with China. A second problem is that the two main rivers, the Mekong, and then what's the river up north? It's not the White. Anyway, the one that goes into the northern part of Vietnam. Both those rivers head up in the foothills of the Himalayas, on the Chinese side of the Himalayas. They both have already been subject to damming and diversion by China. In both cases, Vietnam has an essential dependence on these rivers, and that's especially true of the Mekong. The breadbasket for Vietnam is the Mekong Delta, the water is what supplies it for agricultural growth. That's a serious kind of threat. The third problem that they were having was that they are convinced in Vietnam that we are suffering from global warming. What's happening there is pretty strong evidence. And they already have problems of salt intrusion to the groundwater in the Mekong. The Mekong is just barely above sea level. So they've got two kinds of threats to the Mekong from global warming. One is if the sea level rises enough to flood some of the Mekong, and the other is what it does to the groundwater there and turning it saline. Who's the biggest contributor to the pollution that can be suspected as the cause of global warming? It's China. Who's the second? It's us. And, of course, the Chinese pollution. How many have been to China? Did you notice the pollution? The last time I was there, it was just before the Olympics, and I was in Beijing, and they had cut all of the power consumption or power generation around Beijing to stop the pollution. And I thought it wasn't so bad. It was about like Salt Lake. but as you walked around, if you held a handrail, it was just covered with soot, something that we don't experience at all here in terms of how bad it was. In any event, their pollution goes east. It heads to us. So why would Vietnam be worried about it? Well, pollution that is contributing to global warming is a worldwide event. It doesn't much matter where it's coming from. It's changing the climate around the world. Now, Vietnam feels in every one of these cases that it's going to be essential that it doesn't have to face China alone. Here we had, three Vietnam vets in our group? I think three, who had fought there. And we were being treated with a great friendliness. And at one point, one of our group asked the Vietnamese people, how is it that you can be so friendly to us when the war is still so recent? And the response was, that's easy when we're the winner. But the other reason for it was, and probably the more important reason was, they feel that they need to have some allies in some form. And they've had a lot of experience with us. They've had a lot of experience with the Chinese. And they've had a lot of experience with the French. And there was no question that their experience with us, in spite of the war, was more comfortable than their experiences with the French and the Chinese. And besides that, we had the power that could be useful there. Well, all right, what does that mean in terms of our national security? What it meant to me was that we've got real danger there. It's going to be very easy for us to be sucked in to some kind of military adventure in that part of the world because things are fragile there. And it could easily be that one country or another will find it to their advantage to, wag the dog, to do something that creates an international kind of incident or a military threat to them that helps strengthen them at home. And if you've been to China, you know that the Chinese government right now is fairly vulnerable to dissatisfaction within China. They're not vulnerable in terms of their neighbors, but they are in terms of dissatisfaction within their country. They have several hundred demonstrations a day in China against the government. Now, it's usually at the local level. Usually is local government. And the national government has a very neat way of dealing with this. They depend on the local government to sort of provide the basic kinds of services that are needed. And they just say, you do it and don't get in trouble. It's hard for them to do it without corruption, and there is a lot of corruption in China. Once the corruption is revealed in a particular community, then the national government comes down on them and says, we won't tolerate that, and they change it. So they're able to blame the corruption on the local people without having solved a lot of the problem that there is locally. What is it that would help us in terms of that kind of a fragile part of the world? If there's that kind of fragility, and that we, of course, have interests there, and even if we didn't, really difficult problems there can't help but create problems for us. What would happen if the South China Sea was, in effect, blockaded? What would happen if a country the size of Vietnam, by the way, Vietnam is larger in population than any country in Europe. That might surprise you, but it's just slightly larger than Germany. So there are a lot of people there. What do you think would happen if they lost their ability to support themselves in terms of food because of the Mekong? What can we do in terms of national security? The best way to avoid a war is to have a kind of credible power that people don't want to test. And what is the most important thing to a credible military power? it's not so much how many jets you have. It's not even so much how many aircraft carriers you've got. It's how strong is your economy and how strong is your political capacity in terms of being willing to use that economic strength if it's needed. Why was it such a mistake, I think, I'm exercising some opinion here, but why was it such a mistake for us to go into Iraq at the same time that we were cutting taxes on the highest income people in this country? Well, what did that say about our staying power there? What did that say about the commitment of the real leadership in this country to support that adventure? Yes.
There wasn't any commitment to stay there.
Oh, yeah. Okay, yeah. Well, and that proved it. In my opinion, it proved it. Well, that tends to really increase your vulnerability because it's easier then for another country, you know, say it's China, just for example, if they've got a lot of problem internally to say, look, we're having to fight all of these problems around our border. We need to pull you together. We not only that, we've got problems with the United States. And maybe they'll prove it by some adventure of their own. It's very important for us to be able to show that we have the capability that makes it a real problem for someone to challenge us in that way. Good. Now, beyond that, but still dealing with our national security, there's been a lot of talk in this country about military power and about soft power. Soft power, which has been particularly expressed by a fellow named Nye, who is a political scientist at Harvard, his definition of soft power is it's the power that a government has because it is respected, and particularly because it's respected by other governments and other cultures. We happen to enjoy a lot of soft power. I mean, you sometimes wonder about that with people complaining about the United States and so forth. But you just look at how many people would like to migrate to the United States. And you look at how often the United States is being sought as a partner. We have enormous soft power. But we erode it. We erode it to the extent that we're not able to show that we are treating our people well here in this country, to the extent that we are doing things that are not sensitive to the needs of people in other areas, and to the extent that we're not providing good health care, and to the extent that we are just depending on going into other governments militarily as opposed to trying to provide help in other ways, we're undermining our soft power. And it's the soft power that in the long run is probably going to be more important even than our economic strength, although the two are tied together like that. Okay, well, those are my points about why the high cost of healthcare burdens us with high costs in four areas. Now, just to hit a couple of points beyond that and then open it up to questions. One is, well, so what? Is there any reason to think we could hold down our cost of health care? Well, the solution that is very commonly offered is to turn health care over to competition, you know, to the market. You compare the United States with these other countries that have half the cost of health care, and we are the most market-oriented deliverer of health care among all these countries. Well, what does that mean? Does that mean that really the market doesn't work very well in health care? Or poor doesn't mean that we are just particularly poor at using the market. Actually, I think it's both. There are times you don't want to use the market. There are times in healthcare we ought to use the market more. And there are times we ought to use it less. But it's a mistake to say all we've got to do is turn it over to the market. We've almost done that, and we have twice the cost of healthcare. Now, I'll just throw out some quick examples. You know, one of our big advances in this country and in the rest of the industrialized world has been sanitation. Aren't you glad that you don't have to negotiate with half a dozen companies as to who's going to take away your sewage? That we just have one line running down our streets to do that? Similarly, we used to experiment with private companies in terms of providing fire protection. There are some people who say we ought to experiment with a private market in providing national security. Just each of us have our own guns. Well, there are times when the market works and times when it doesn't. Now, I think we ought to be using the market much more in terms of controlling our pollution. We ought to be sure that the polluters are paying the full cost. And I'm a polluter. I don't pay anywhere near the full cost of my pollution that occurs because of our driving our car. I think we ought to be burdened with that. So it's not a matter of whether or not we're market-oriented or not, and it's certainly not a matter of whether or not we're capitalists or socialists. It's a matter of thinking about when are the right places to use a market and when are the right places to use public services. Well, and what we've discovered in this country, what we've documented, is at least our form of that mix of government and public is a very inefficient form. So if it's twice as much, and other countries have been able to do it at half the cost, that's a reason to think we could do something. I don't think we're that dumb that we can't. Second reason is the Institute of Medicine has just published a report, well, it's probably 6 months ago, where they brought together a group of people who were some of the best students of health policy in this country and said, look, if we're so expensive, what are the ways that we could reasonably expect to reduce the cost? And they looked at them and ended up making a tabulation of what they thought were savings that were reasonably feasible, not necessarily politically, but reasonably feasible technically and economically, that would reduce the cost of health care in the United States by 30%. Now, that's a huge amount. That's 6% of our gross domestic product. And just to tick off the areas, one was in terms of the unnecessary services that are often not just unnecessary but are harmful. That was the largest one. The second one was excessive administrative costs, and that would be particularly with the nature of our insurance market. The third was inefficiently delivered services, and that was particularly from the fragmentation of our health delivery services. The next was that some of the prices are too high, like in pharmaceuticals and medical equipment and so forth. Next was fraud. And then next was missed prevention opportunities. I actually think there's much more in that one than what they thought, but the missed opportunities we have of disease prevention and health promotion that other countries use better than we do, by the way, and I'm open to discuss that. Okay, if we've got that kind of evidence that we can reduce healthcare costs, how do we go about trying to do it? Well, we've got some potential models. You've probably heard about the extent to which Intermountain Healthcare here in Utah is put up as a model, one of several. I mean, it's not a unique one, but one that seems to be providing healthcare of better quality and at lower costs than what we have in most of the country. that we also have some of that developing at the University of Utah as they are moving to medical home and accountable health care. We also see it in the VA. The VA, which we always thought was really second quality health care, has in the last, what, I guess, would you say 15 years or two decades, made enormous strides. So it in some ways is now near the top in terms of the quality of their health care. Now, notice something in all three of these examples. These are all larger institutions that have been able to manage the health care delivery system more as a system. They've become much more dependent on information technology. They've become much more proficient at pulling together teams of healthcare providers. Now, some of the things that are being talked about right now, like the medical home and the accountable care organizations, could be said to be, well, this is just a rebirth of HMOs, and we had a bad experience with HMOs. Well, I don't think it's necessarily a rebirth of HMOs. Because the HMO was particularly, the model of HMO was particularly a centralized administration model. It was particularly bringing in an MBA to solve the problems as if that's where you'd find the solution. What these solutions at least have a capability of doing, and I think this is the theory behind them, is to pull it together more at the bottom. It's a more bottom-up kind of thing than a top-down. It's to pull together the physicians, the nurses, the other healthcare providers in effective teams. If you're having to go into a major kind of surgery and you don't know where to go, what's the most important question for you to ask? By the way, this may save your life sometime. What's the most important question for you to ask of, say, the physician you're talking with about doing the surgery?
Do you take my insurance?
Oh, yeah, that's a barrier question. Yes, they won't even take you if you don't have insurance. They'll take. Yes, that's certainly. Oh, and then they build you for it.
Yeah.
That's not the answer I was trying to get at, but that's a perfectly good answer. But right now, you know, with the Affordable Care Act, we're supposed to now all be covered. We won't be, but anyway, most of us will be. So hopefully that's a question that we're moving beyond. But if you read Time Magazine, the last issue of Time Magazine, that's clearly an issue there. Yeah. Okay. Oh, well, you could, yes. But now, how does that deal with the question of whether or not they've got a high mortality rate because they've been willing to take the tough cases? Now I won't name the hospital, but one of our really important local hospitals developed a new procedure. I mean, they decided to focus on a new procedure to try to establish real reputation in that area. So for the first couple of years, they were very selective as to the patients they put through this procedure. It was hard to get the procedure if you needed it, because they wanted to be sure that you were going to survive. Now, that's a problem itself in terms of our healthcare delivery system, if that's how it's being run. But that'd still be a good question. But I'd suggest that the most important question for you to ask, which is not unrelated to that, is how many times do you do this procedure during a year, and do you do it with the same team? It's how experienced are you in terms of this procedure? Well, what's happening in these new things like the accountable care and the medical home is to try, one of the things that's happening is to try to build teams that have worked together and have the skill. I mean, what is it that makes, why is a coach so important in basketball or with the Jazz? Why is it that you have spring training that is so long in baseball? It's not just that the stars are that good. It's that the stars have got to come together in ways that they really understand each other, and that if you go back to who was our great team here of in basketball, Malone and Stockton, you know, if it, you're probably too young to remember Malone and Stockton. but in terms of how effectively Stockton ran that screen so that Malone had the good shot. I mean, that was the two of them. They could do it without even opening their eyes because they knew just where the other one was and what the moves were. That's the kind of thing that we need in healthcare and that we're trying to get at. And these teams are building from the bottom up, and not only is it including all the providers that we've talked about, it's also including the patient. Including the patient much more actively than has been the case before. What's happening from these kinds of things? We have had a somewhat leveling off of healthcare costs in the last couple of years, but it's hard to know if that's because of the economy or because of early experiments with this kind of thing. We have had this remarkable transformation of the VA, which has been more that way. Intermountain Healthcare is known particularly for the work of Brent James, which is exactly this kind of thing, where by the regular working with the team, they cut down post-operative infections from a sort of reasonable rate of what was reasonable nationally of 2%. They cut it down to half of 1% just by going through this kind of teamwork training. Well, Medicaid could also be a model, although it has problems because this legislature is constantly trying to second-guess it. I think it'll have a little more trouble. We've got the past director of the Utah Medicaid program here, and they have done some interesting kind of experiments in the Medicaid program. It'd be natural if we could better use it that way. Well, all right. With all of that, all of those things will be helpful and I think not sufficient. And they won't be sufficient because of the power of the lobbyists and the extent to which the lobbyists can constrain what we do. For example, that right now, although the VA is allowed to put out to bid its purchasing of pharmaceuticals, Medicare is not. Why is it not? Because Congress has been lobbied by the pharmaceuticals to prohibit them from putting it out to bid, and so they can't do it. We had a terrible time here in Utah, and you don't have to confirm this or deny it, but we had a terrible time trying to get some changes in the prescriptions that were used in Medicaid because the legislature, it was insisting that it was the legislature's role to decide how we would purchase the pharmaceuticals rather than the health department and the providers. Okay, that's a huge problem, and I have for some decades argued we will never have really effective kind of reform of health care until we have nationally financed elections. That's to free our elected officials from the power of the lobbyists. I think we need to work on that power two ways. One is to free the elected officials, so they're not dependent on the lobbyists to finance their campaigns. and also to restrict the power of the lobbyists in terms of just how blatantly and how secretly and how extensively they can use their power, either their power of votes from their members or the bigger power that they exercise, the power of their money. Just one last point. If you go back to those four points that I talked about and talk about where should the responsibility for it be, there are two things that come out. One is you can't separate one of these points from the others. They're all interrelated. And the second one is, by and large, the federal government is in a far better position to do this than the state governments are. And I'd be glad to defend that, but given the time, I instead will open it up to comments, questions, challenges, or whatever.
We'll now devote the remainder of the time to questions. We have a few minutes, so if you have a question, please speak clearly into the microphone. State your name and something about yourself.
Hi, my name is Satine. I'm an international relations major, and I'm also pre-med. My question for you is, I've heard the argument, I think I find it one of the better arguments, I guess, against any sort of like kind of Affordable Care Act health care measures, is that the United States is responsible for a lot of the innovation and research in the medical field. We produce a lot of drugs and that are kind of on the edge of medicine because of how much money is in healthcare. If we were to take that incentive away, a lot of the innovation would disappear.
Okay. There are two parts to that. One is, what is the incentive? Their primary incentive in terms of actually using innovation, let me be clear the two parts I'm talking about. One is the part of the incentive for innovation, and the other is the incentive to use the innovation. On the incentive to use the innovation, I think that's in the market already. If they know of an innovation and they're able then to market it, that they will use it in general. Now, there I'd have to make a qualification. I'll come back to that. But the bigger issue, and the one that I think they rely on mostly when they make this argument, and that argument's constantly made by the pharmaceutical industry, that they need that money in order to discover the innovation, you know, to be able to finance the research. It is very expensive to bring a new product to market, like $1 billion. And they say, we've got to have that in order to do it. Well, two things. One is there are innovations coming up in other countries that haven't had to find that big an incentive. Secondly, that incentive is not very well directed. How much of it is going to the higher salaries of the executives? How much of it is going to the perks within it? How much of it is going to find new ways to use the drug that they already had, which primarily means going into marketing? How can you start marketing it for another purpose? When you look at the real innovations in pharmaceuticals, the basic kinds of innovations are those that are being made mostly by our universities. It's the basic research. Most of the expenditure within the pharmaceuticals is finding additional ways to use the same thing and finding the market for it. Now, I think that they have some grounds to be concerned about how expensive the regulation is. But I don't think we ought to just reduce the regulation. I think that deserves some careful attention, and maybe we can get the price down to less than $1 billion. And in fact, the pharmaceutical, this is such a good story. I was in a national discussion of healthcare that was financed, like many national discussions of healthcare are, by the pharmaceutical industry. They were the ones that paid for this discussion. And as is usual the case, a representative of the pharmaceutical industry was then at some point allowed to make a statement. And so the chief executive of one of our largest pharmaceutical companies, a fellow who drives to work in a helicopter, made his statement, and he said, there are just two things I want to tell you. One is that we are too highly regulated. We need to have less regulation. And secondly, we need to have more patent protection. Now, how do those two things relate? The patent protection is a regulation. He wanted that regulation and wasn't even recognizing the conflict, the contradiction in what he was saying. But everyone in the group did, and it was just fun to see all the smiles. Anyway, it's a good question and one that deserves some work. Oh, where's the mic? You've got the mic. Good.
My name is Matt Morissette, and I'm a senior here at the U. And my question involved one specific state-level solution, which is in Vermont, where they wanted to do a single-payer healthcare system. And do you think that type of solution would work? Is it effective, and could it be a model for a national healthcare system?
Yeah. Will it work? Sort of, and in some instances, could it be a model for the national? Yes. I mean, it will work much better at the national level than it will at the state level. There are huge problems in implementing it at the state level, which I'd be glad to talk about. But at the national level, it would solve enormous problems. Huge problems. let's get to other questions. I'd be glad to talk to you about it.
My name is Zachary Reed. I'm a student here at the U, and I have a family members, pharmacists, nurses in the healthcare system, and they believe, in their opinion, that they can provide a superior product to the consumer under a private system rather than a public system. I'm wondering how you feel about that.
My own sense is that I'm substantially more favorable to the providers being private than I am to the payer. So I would, where did you go, who just asked it? Oh, way back, yeah. So in terms of the providers, the physicians, the hospitals, the pharmacies and so forth, I would not at this point anyway be pushing for nationalization of them. But it's different in terms of the payer. So the Canadian system, which has nationalized in effect, sort of, the payer system, but still most of the care is provided by, you know, by private organizations. I think that model's really worth looking at.
Hi, Bob. I'm Noel DeNevers. I'm your fellow geriatric. would you say a few words about death panels?
Yeah. Now, that shows the problem of the politicization of healthcare reform. I mean, the idea behind that was a very useful one, and that it was that we would establish good consultations for individuals and for their families, people who were clearly facing death, to talk about what their choices were and so forth. And so the opponents labeled it as death panel. That was a clever way to establish something against it. That's the key point I'd make. But a second one is, you'll often hear that most of the cost of healthcare is in the last year of life. And you'll hear people say it's 75 or 80%. That is hugely exaggerated. That in the Medicare program, which is where we have the best data, it's something a little less than 30% is in the last year. And then besides that, it is very difficult to know when you're in your last year. And there have been studies that have tried to do that by interviewing the physician, by interviewing the patient, by interviewing the nurse, by interviewing the family. And the predictive power a year ahead is almost nil. Now, it turns out that you can predict it very well if you're only predicting it for 2 weeks. But in the last 2 weeks of life, healthcare costs are low because you've stopped doing extraordinary care.
Well, this concludes today's forum. Please join me in thanking our guest.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you.